The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So our body is a major part of our experience in life. The body can definitely be a big challenge with pain and disease and aging. And the body can also be a great joy. You know, it is, after all, how we can be here in life, connecting with others, doing the things that we do. So our relationship with bodily experience can be skillful or it can be unskillful. There are actually many ways that we don't relate to it very well. We often get stuck in patterns of reactivity or habitual ideas that we never challenge. Now, just as a few examples, we may look at the body and judge it based on how it is in relation to societal norms. And then we decide this isn't right, or something is wrong with that part. Very common. Or we may think that the body looks pretty good in relation to societal norms, and we can be proud of the body, or, you know, work hard to show off how good it looks in various ways. And then there are other kinds of obsessions we can get caught in. So some people get obsessed with perfecting their health. They have a complicated diet with many supplements and exercise and the right skin and hair products. It can be an all-day project just to manage all of that. And it's not that we don't do any of that. It's important to take care, but for some it becomes a religion. And if there's some difficulty with the body, we can get obsessed about that also. Maybe we don't even realize that's possible until something happens that's medically significant. We have to work on getting a diagnosis for something that's going wrong, but it's not clear right away, and there are more tests and visits to specialists. And then the mind gets into a loop of thinking about it again and again, creating an ongoing story and then refining it with each new piece of information that comes in. And all of these various obsessions are really just forms of dukkha, of suffering, difficulty. Of course, some people just see their body as functional. It's a means of moving their head around. Donald Rothberg, another Dharma teacher, talks about early in his practice, he had a moment where he was doing walking meditation, maybe on one of his first retreats, and he had this image, this idea come to mind. He said, "I'm just consciousness on a pole." He realized he didn't have very much sense of his body. It was just a means of transporting his head around. So there's all this, right? There's all these relationships and that we have, and we don't always realize what it is, or we don't realize our potential for it until, you know, something shifts and then we get into one of these loops. So this is all what's called bodily sankhara. Sankhara being a Pali word that means a construction in the mind. It's how we construct the body in the mind. How do we see the body? How do we create it as an idea? So that's kind of the, you know, the story about it is kind of the gross bodily sankhara. And then there's actually more subtle sankhara that goes on where we only pick up certain aspects of experience, right? The body has the five sense doors, and they're wide open, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. But the amount of data that's coming in through those sense doors is much more than we could really get consciously. And so the question is, how is it selected for you when you feel touch, which visual things you're attracted to, when do you notice sound? How does that all work for you is done below the level of your conscious choice. And that's also called a sankhara in Buddhism. The Buddha considered that significant. So our prior understandings have a lot to do with what we're even willing to take in, what percentage of what we see comes in and gets seen consciously. So that's more subtle. So in Buddhist practice, we are encouraged, even enjoined, to understand this constructing, understand this process of being with the body, being in a body. What is that? It's a source of dukkha if we don't understand it well. Very easy to get into dukkha, grasping, aversion. So we've put together our experience of the body from all kinds of subconscious ideas, expectations, past experiences, emotions. So many things have gone into how we are currently experiencing having a body. So the body that we see in the mirror is just really just one way to perceive it. We're strongly conditioned to see the body in a very conceptual way like that because we've done it for so long and because that's kind of how we interact with other bodies. We see other bodies, right? And then we see our body. So many of these classical body meditations that are offered in this tradition and then various other contemplations also are designed to undermine or break down our habitual concepts to help us get unstuck from all of these bodily sankharas. And they're designed to connect us to the direct experience of the body, where we're not doing so much constructing. So the direct experience, like we pointed to in the elements, is, you know, solidity, for example. That's pretty basic. But then if I turn it into, oh, this is, you know, I'm feeling some tension in my leg, there's solidity. Oh, probably, you know, probably there's a problem with my muscle. I wonder if I'm going to have surgery to, you know, fix all of this. That's a lot of construction, right? But the basic experience of the tension or the solidity, that's more direct. I mean, we can just consider how varied our experience of the body is. It actually feels very different when we're tired or when we're awake or when we're happily engaged in something, like say we're doing an art project or something, the body feels different. When we're sick, we have the flu, doesn't feels very different. If we get on a trapeze and we hang upside down, feels different. How could we say that there's just my body or even the body? It's like it's a different world from moment to moment. When we're sleeping, what is the body? So in the discourse that talks about how to establish mindfulness, how to create or dwell in this quality of awareness that we're cultivating, the body is the first, connecting with the body is the first way to do that. It's the first, called the first establishment of mindfulness. That's in the Satipatthana Sutta. So we might think that this means we're supposed to be mindful of the body. That's a phrase that gets used in the modern world. Be mindful of this, be mindful of that. Very popular in the secular mindfulness understanding. But in the earliest Buddhist teachings, the language isn't quite like that. It's more like the establishments of mindfulness are areas of experience that are conducive to establishing mindfulness. So if we pay attention to the body, that will make it more likely that the quality of sati, mindfulness, will arise in the mind. Do you hear the subtle difference there? It's not just a command, you need to be mindful of your body. So when we pay attention to the body in the right way, we bring about this dwell in this wholesome quality of mindfulness. And it says in the sutta, the language used is that we're instructed to contemplate the body as a body, ardent, fully aware, and mindful, setting aside covetousness and grief for the world. So that's how we pay attention to the body in the right way, so that we temporarily don't allow ourselves to get caught up in all of what we want, don't want, what should happen, what is happening, why isn't this happening, all that that goes on about the world. We temporarily set that aside and just dwell in the body as a body. This body, ardent, clearly aware, and mindful. And when we do this, we start to see the body differently and more accurately, I might add. We also open up a path to more subtle sensations. There's an evolution of bodily experience if we're connecting with it in this correct way, this way of right mindfulness, where we open up a channel to subtle sensations that are not so evident when we're caught up in our top-level concepts and our stories. Even when we're caught up in ideas like my knee or my spine that hurts, you know. There's no, as I said at the beginning, there's no sensation called knee. It's more fundamental than that. So Dharma teachings rightly suggest that the body is an excellent vehicle for freeing the heart and mind because it has this potential to get us unstuck. And we saw this first today in the meditation on the elements, where we use the five elements of earth, water, fire, wind, and space. So this practice asks us to touch into the mixture of experiences in the body that we could call solidity, liquidity, heat, motion, and space. And they're not fundamentally different from external experiences of those. So we see that the body, which we normally hold as so special and mine and unique, is really the experience of it is very similar to the experience we have in other parts of the world. It's just internally. And you may have noticed that these experiences can get a little bit more subtle, maybe throughout the course of a day. That can happen. They're kind of energetic sensations in the end. And we'll say more about that in a moment. And the element practice in particular is meant to lead to an insight or an understanding of not self, of, you know, the body as not fundamentally unique and separate from nature. It's kind of arising out of the same stuff as nature. And then we looked more specifically at the direct sensations of the breath, and these too can come to feel like subtle energies in the body. It becomes less about in-breath, out-breath, less about my lungs and, you know, those kinds of body parts, but really more about a feeling just of a flow in and out or even just up and down. So this is actually a recognized realm of practice, these subtle sensations that I'm calling energetic. Meditation practice attunes us to these sensations that we tend not to notice in everyday life. If we're caught up in kind of top-level bodily feelings and our constant mental chatter, we can't hear the more quiet sounds that are coming from this deeper layer of our being. Kind of like if we're out on a busy city street and there's cars honking and, you know, a lot of sounds. We don't hear, we wouldn't hear bird song, for example, quiet bird song or quiet music playing. We just wouldn't notice it. But if we sit quietly and we let our mind settle a little bit, then the inner world kind of springs to life. It shows itself. So I recommend getting familiar with the subtle energy of the body. It may not be available right away. And even if you didn't touch into it today, it's helpful. I'm going to talk about it a little bit. It will be helpful to hear about it in case it does at some point. But essentially, these subtle energies are below the level of the analytical mind that's always trying to figure things out and think through things. So we discover sensations that could be described by words like tension, tight spot, dense spot, knot, or wall, along with forces that, you know, like forces or energy flows. And then also feelings like ease, lightness, gentle ripples, softness. There can be pain or heat or tightness, these more basic sensations. And we can choose to connect with these and explore them right there at the level of sensation, energy, tightness, flowing. And if we stay with these, I'll just assert, you'll have to check for yourself and experience, but there is a possibility for healing and for insight. These energies are indications of places where there can be stuckness in the mind that's manifesting in the body. We can kind of heal and free the mind more deeply when we go below our level of thought and abstract, the kind of high-level abstract world of words. There are things that aren't available at that level that become available at this more subtle level. So let me offer a few practical notes about doing energy practice, this kind of energy practice, in case you touched into it today or in case you might want to in the future. So a good strategy when we notice a knot or a tight spot is to gently pass the breath energy through it. And if it won't go through, then pass it around it. That's fine. But we kind of want to have a sense that there can be motion nearby a sensation like that. It challenges the mind's tendency to think of the knot as something solid or wall-like or, you know, not like impenetrable. We can think of it that way. And if it feels useful, you can even infuse the breath energy with love or compassion as it flows through these tighter spots in the body. It's also very common if we work with at this energetic level to have sudden emotional feelings that seem to sort of emerge from that. Feelings like fear or despair or anger or sadness. And I again encourage treating these as energy flows. We don't need to then say, oh, I need to attend to this sadness. What's that coming from? Where's the story? What might be the cause in my childhood? Just treat them as energy flows. Let them pass through along with the accompanying heat or cold, other sensations. There may be stories or images that come, but they can just be noted. You don't need to enter or dwell upon them because we want to stay below that level. And if there are tears, we can just let those come. But we don't really want to let the energy or the attention collapse into the emotion that's happening. So in general, we want to soften rather than resist all these various tensions and flows. So softening rather than resisting. But meeting clearly rather than collapsing. Do you see that there's kind of a balance? So we want to touch into it and meet it, but not like that. So not to contact it so hard. So the aim is not to end all tensions in the body. It's easy to get into that idea. Well, this needs to go away. I got to work through this. When this releases, it's going to be, that's the right thing. I mean, yes, that is useful when we can shift something in the mind-body system. But it's more useful to think that this kind of energy work is supporting a path of tranquility and insight in ways that may not be totally knowable to us. You know, it might not be that the aim is to get through that tension as soon as possible. Instead, sort of by engaging with the bodily knots and feeling how they shift and change, the mind is actually learning. It's learning how it creates its own tension, because these are sankharas. These are bodily sankharas. They're things that we've created. So it learns how it creates its own tension. It learns how cause and effect work. It learns how the body and the mind are interrelated. It learns how perception works. And it learns how to calm the energies of the life process. Life is a process. There's always going to be some tension coming and going, some shifts, some changes, some discomfort, some comfort. We're not trying to have a totally comfortable, tension-free body for the rest of our life. That's not what it's like for an enlightened person. But engaging with that gives us so much insight into all of that, how it all works, so that we can stop doing the creations that are genuinely dukkha. You know, but even the Buddha had difficulties with his body. So if this is of interest, you know, the first step maybe is to have the idea that it's possible. So that's partly why I talk about it. And it is framed in the commentarial teachings in this way, talking about bodily knots and energetic flows. Sometimes we haven't gone into the deeper layers of the body simply because we didn't know that they existed. But there's a whole world waiting for you in there, below the level of seeing my body as how it is in the mirror and as seeing it even as parts like my knee and my back. So where does this lead? We don't exactly find freedom from the body in a transcendent sense. That's not what we aim for in this practice. But we do find some freedom through the body. And then maybe after we've entered into the body deeply, maybe then we find some freedom from it, but in a more integrated way. The body is also one of the, there's a group called the khandhas. I don't want to talk about them too much, but these are the ways that we construct our identity out of experience, and one of them is the body. I talked about the bodily identity that we often carry, and then there are other ones related to the mind. And the sankharas are one of the later khandhas. They're the stories that we create. They're one of the other of these khandhas, usually translated as aggregates, not the best word, it's kind of abstract sounding. But the reason I brought in that word is because, not because I want to talk about it much, but because I want to read some verses by a 20th century Thai forest monk named Ajahn Mun, who was well known in Thailand, very deep practitioner. And then this is, I guess, his kind of liberation poem. And he titled it, I guess it's translated from the Thai, but he titled it, it's translated, The Ballad of Liberation from the Khandhas. So we become liberated from these identities that we create in our body and our mind, one of them being literally our body, the other one being the kind of the sankharas that we've constructed, these constructions that we make. And there are some other ones. So this is the ballad of liberation from liberation. Let's just say the ballad of liberation from being attached to mind and body. Once there was a man who loved himself and feared distress. He wanted happiness beyond the reach of danger, so he wandered endlessly. Wherever people said that happiness was found, he longed to go, but wandering took a long, long time. He was the sort of man who loved himself and really dreaded death. He truly wanted release from aging and mortality. Then, one day, he came to know the truth, abandoning the cause of suffering and compounded things. That word compounded things is sankhara. He found a cave of wonders, of endless happiness, that is, the body. As he gazed throughout the cave of wonders, his suffering was destroyed, his fears appeased. He gazed and gazed around the mountainside, experiencing unbounded peace. But then there was another man afraid of death, his heart all withered and discouraged. He came to me and spoke frankly in a pitiful way. He said, "You've made an effort at your meditation for a long time now. Have you seen it yet, the true Dhamma of your dreams?" He asked to stay with me, so I agreed. I said to him, "I'll take you to a massive mountain with a cave of wonders, free from suffering and stress, mindfulness immersed in the body. You can view it at your leisure to cool your heart and end your troubles. This is the path of the noble lineage. It's up to you to go or not." It's kind of nice. So he talks about the body as a cave of wonders, something that we can gaze around like a mountainside. And what does he say? His suffering was destroyed, his fears appeased. So, you know, we might, this cures a lot of those unskillful relationships to the body that I mentioned, you know, where we hate it or we love it or we want to manipulate it into something of our desires. How about gazing at it, connecting with it, and really feeling it deeply? Potentially, it's liberating to do that, to really see how the body works. Maybe you can understand to some degree what's pointed to in this poem, kind of prose poem, after today's practice. So bodily issues are not going away. The Buddha still had back pain, and he died of an intestinal illness after consuming food that wasn't good. But he remained fully embodied through all of that. Mindfulness of the body is said to allow a person to handle all kinds of pain, as well as, I'm quoting from a sutta now, ill-spoken words, fear and dread, and discontent and delight. Interesting that we're asked to be able to handle delight. But the mindfulness of the body helps us handle all kinds of things, fear, pain, ill-spoken words. You know, by having mindfulness of the body, if someone is angry with us, we can handle that better. Very interesting, this connection between mind and body. The Buddha saw it so profoundly, just like Ajahn Mun did. I imagine we would easily be able to acknowledge and handle our own death as the Buddha was, by being mindful of the body, by really cultivating that practice. And interestingly, understanding the body, at least something about the body, has a relational side too. This is a verse from the Dhammapada. "Many do not realize that we here must die. For those who realize this, quarrels end." So there's an ethical and compassionate side, seeing the possibility and in fact the inevitability of our own death. We want to live in a way that doesn't create so much conflict. Why would we get entangled in quarrels, knowing that we and the other person are going to die in the end? So as a kind of final suggestion, we didn't touch into this today, but another very classical body practice is mindfulness of death. And if you're intrigued by that, I recommend it. If you're not intrigued, it doesn't feel like the right time, that's okay. But sometimes our understanding of the body is too conceptual and we need to get very subtle. And sometimes our understanding of the body is not really gross enough, if you will. Death is the number one fact about the body. That's where it's going. And bringing that into awareness can actually really help to counter some of the unskillful views that I talked about at the beginning, judging or hating the body, taking pride, or ignoring the body. Mindfulness of death is another way to sharpen us up and not have those unskillful relationships. So I hope what bodily practice does for us is it encourages us to be kind of open-minded and curious about the body. What is this? It's a cave of wonders. What did you discover today in the cave of wonders? Was there anything that was kind of different maybe than you thought or saw something new? It's a great resource for practice, the body. And if we've just been living conventional life in the usual way, I don't think we really know what the body is. We've barely scratched the surface of what's available through bodily life. So I'm delighted that you wanted to come to a whole day long on mindfulness of the body, and I hope it offers some potential for insight, healing, intrigue, wonder, amazement, love, all the good qualities that come from practice.